Welcome to the Ludogogi Podcast, your monthly games-based learning earworm. I'm Antonis.
And I'm Sarah. And today's guest is Jenna Moran. Jenna Moran is an RPG designer and novelist. She got her start writing additional source books for existing RPGs, including Steve Jackson's Innomine and White Wolf's Exalted, and then co-authored the games Ex Machina along with further editions of Exalted. She started work on her own RPG in the 1990s, resulting in the diceless game Nobilis, in which player characters are servants of the gods trying to save reality from destruction. The second edition of this game won her the Diana Jones Award for Excellence in 2003. In 2015, Jenna released Chabot's Marvelous Wish-Granting Machine, a game with links to Nobilis, but drawing further inspiration from Studio Ghibli films, children's TV and literature and folklore. She maintained for several years a blog-style collection of stories under the title Hither Be Dragons, and has written several novels, some of which are related to the Nobilis setting and other to Hither Be Dragons. Jenna comes to us via a recommendation from previous guest Jay Dragon, who was playtesting her soon-to-be-kickstarted game, Far Roofs, at the time of appearing on the podcast. Welcome, Jenna.
Thank you.
One of the things we like to do with all of our guests when they arrive is to ask them for a little-known fact about themselves that maybe people who know them well don't know about them. So if you have one of those, we'd love to hear it.
Oh, sure. I think many people don't know that I actually got my start in gaming when I was around 5 and was absolutely convinced that the way the whole process worked was you'd write a module and you send it into the gaming companies, and in return, they send back vast wealth, stuff like, you know, bespoke plastic chainmail suits, that kind of thing. This turned out not to be true, and by the time I found out, it was too late, but that's the secret origin of Jenna Moran.
I think it's just very disappointing that the world doesn't work that way, especially if you've, you know...
I know, right?
Definitely.
It's true. So tell us, Jenna, do you have any specific process that you get ideas for your games, or where does your inspiration come from?
Oh, to be honest, I am probably embarrassingly a bit like ChatGPT or something here, in that my actual process is like, imagine that you've already written this. What does it say? And it's not like I do this consciously, but when I find myself slowing down in fiction writing or whatever, I'll notice that I'm kind of listening, metaphorically at least, for the fuzzy echo of what I'm going to say from the future. When I slow down in game design, I often like have this inchoate fuzzy picture in my head that I'm like trying to resolve. So I listen to it, or I stare at it. And then, because this is an intuitive process and doesn't actually do much of the polishing work, I have to do tons and tons of editing and iteration. But that's the basic process.
So it's a very kind of intuitive kind of way of going around finding ideas. Do you feel like they kind of come to you rather than you necessarily having some kind of way of making them happen?
I think they're already there. I think that game design in general, most artistic activities, is just reflecting out what the world has already given you, you know, for good or for better or for worse. So like, you know, you get stuff that your friends say to you in conversations, you go out and experience the world, you eat really strange things, and all of this produces a boiling swamp down in the subconscious or whatever that already has everything that you're going to say from there. You just have to like dig it out.
Mm. I think like all products of creativity, there is a lot that comes from the inside out and is expressed through your game design in this case, or different art forms in other cases. So I'm wondering, are you asking yourself specific questions that help you with this intuitive process to verbalize it?
I mean, sometimes I will try to do specific things. Mostly, I mean, I like symmetry a lot. I like the idea that the writing style and the concept and the setting and the rules should all have structural parallels. They should be isomorphic to one another. And, you know, my theory is like, oh, every game, every work starts with a statement of what is and ends with how you want to feel about it, how you want them to feel about it. But ultimately, even though I have a few tricks like that, I mostly really am just, this is what it is already. and pulling it out.
Like backwards engineering from an idea to the constructs of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Our last guest, who was Richard Bartle, the inventor of MUDs, he said something really interesting, which was the idea that when you're wanting to create something, if you're thinking to yourself that you want to create a game, that the question you should ask yourself is there a reason why this should be a game? Is there any other way in which I could do it? Or is the only answer to what I'm trying to do a game? And I guess that must be something that's quite pertinent to you because you do both novel writing and games design. So is there a difference between something that you feel should become a novel or a piece of literature and something which should become a game?
First, I want to note that it was awesome that you managed to have Richard Bartle on because MUDs were basically foundational for me.
Yes.
I think that... I mean, the main difference is obviously interactivity. If you're writing a game, you're trying to customize the experience for people. If you're writing a novel, you're trying to explain something in a way that people will resonate with it. And that's kind of different. It's basically whether the kind of work needs contribution from them on more of a level than just understanding. Fiction is a conversation too, between the writer and the reader, but it's not as intensive a conversation as a game can be. So that's probably the difference.
Yeah, I would say so, because a novel kind of still exists without a reader being there, but a game can't exist until it's played. I guess that's one of the things that I think about.
Yeah,
because play is sort of one of the ingredients of what's actually happening. Yeah. So
yeah.
Do you have this is something we ask everybody, do you have a favorite game mechanic? And if so, how have you used it in your games and how did it work out?
I mean, my favorite game mechanic ever, which is very difficult to integrate into a game, is the times when you have like a miniature set up for like D&D or whatever, and you have a cat. And the cat comes over, knocks over the miniatures, and you make that diegetic. And I love that so much. and there's an old internet story about Sir Barrington, who was a rogue in D&D 3rd edition, who the player didn't want to or couldn't figure out a way to make them talk. So they invested in the skill innuendo, which lets you add subtext to the things you say or your vocalizations. And so the bear would roar and the butler would say, "Oh yes, Sir Barrington welcomes you," or whatever. Technically there's nothing in the game world that proves that Sir Barrington said anything at all. And I think the connection here is I really like taking inanimate objects, or animals, or even the dice, things that aren't nominally alive and full of intentionality, and saying, well, what happens if we take their actions as having that intentionality in it? And I have used that in games, and it went over pretty well. So I think that's the answer.
You do get some inspiration from Studio Ghibli and Miyazaki's work, right?
Oh, yes. This is not so much that I want to. It's just that their movies are so good. it's just filled.
It kind of seeps in, I suppose.
Yeah, like that swamp I was talking about. A lot of it is obviously from real life, but there's this large section of that subconscious swamp that's just filled with the suit sprites and the dragon from Spirited Away, that kind of thing.
So in your game design career, what has been the biggest challenge that you've faced so far?
So I have this thing that I think a lot, which is that the actual greatest challenge in game design isn't the technical side of it. It's that, you know, the more fun conversations you have, I said this already to some extent, the more hope you have, the more happiness you have, the more sunlight, the more good food, the more experience, the better your work is going to be. And what I hate about that is you can't actually control it. You can't make it happen. You can't force your friends to have interesting conversations with you. You can't necessarily afford to do all of the nourishment that you have. But that's so foundational to actually doing game design that it feels a little weird to talk about anything else as a challenge. I went to China once to work with ES Press. And for the first few months there, we were this super smoothly running engine. Everyone had a purpose. I wrote like 170,000 words in 3 months, half of it a game, half of it like art and production notes for the game. And it was great. And I was full of enthusiasm. Things were new. Things were exciting. I came back to the States to finish up some vaccination and visa stuff. Got stranded there for a few months here for a few months by travel snafus. And when I got back, it turned out I had been overestimating that smoothly running engine a bit, because there hadn't been much motion on art or production, but they had opened a maid cafe. Hmm. And I don't think I've ever recovered from that fully. so like, that is the most important challenge. I guess I could talk a bit more about a technical challenge if you would like, mm-hmm. which would probably be for Exalted, the Fair Folk. Exalted is fundamentally a very realistic game. It's it has a whole layer of superheroic stuff, but at its root, the world is modeled on our politics, on our economy. The rules are modeled on a very brutal Bronze Age kind of existence that the characters can mostly ignore. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately for Exalted, the Fair Folk, what I was trying to build were these creatures who interacted with the world on a narrative level, and they weren't even more powerful. It wasn't like they were standing outside the story, you know, playing with everyone else like puppets. They were just, their actual interaction with the world was narrative. And it was also been established long before I got there that they were made of nothing, that they lived in nothing. And I actually can't say for sure that I totally roast that challenge. There were some flaws in the final work. But the thing that I did find that was a useful note for the future is that if you take the foundational assumptions that you're going in anyway, if you take, in Exalted's case, you know, everyone has a character. The characters are different. The game plays out in a place. It plays out over time. Things exist. Even though those aren't exactly true to the setting, of the Fair Folk, Exalted assumed them. Even though you don't have to assume them in every game, there's a game where everyone is John and so you're not playing different people or whatever. But like, if you have those assumptions as bare bones as they be, because no one's going to be excited by a game like no other, where you play a character that's different from the other characters in a place and a time. But if you take those pieces and you add a bunch of interesting lore and mysticism, things for the brain to grapple with around them, you'll get mm-hmm. something that's at least somewhat interesting. If like someone kidnaps you and says, oh, I'm not going to let you go until you do a game with tic-tac-toe resolution, you can at least say, this is what an X means. You know, fill that up with all kinds of things. X is erasure. X is the two, like the Tao gives rise to one, gives rise to two, gives rise to many. You know, O is a different form of not, whatever. Playing is sacred and cool. And you have something, at least. That's what I'd say on that.
What you just said just reminded me, I can't even remember who said it now. Somebody said that games were just about creating interesting obstacles for people to overcome. I can't even remember. It might have been Bernard Suits or somebody like that. It was one of those kinds of people. How do you go about kind of guiding your players through the games, or do you do that, or do you give them very much freedom to sort of interpret what they should do next?
So I think the players are the great randomizer. This is why most of my games don't use dice, because it's like you mentioned earlier about the difference between games and fiction. If you're in a game, you're wanting the players to talk about themselves, to express themselves throughout the game. So I don't know if I would say that I do a lot of guidance there. I do a lot of assistance. I do a lot of help. but everything is like intended to sort of just be there if you reach for it rather than telling you what to do. I am really bad actually at writing the writing form where you tell people what to do.
Yeah, it's because I think I can't remember exactly when you said it, but you said something like that people can ignore it if they like, or they can do what they want. So it sounds like you make these things available for people, but you're leaving it open to them to interpret your rule set, your what you've written in whatever way they feel like. Is that close to the mark?
Yeah, I mean, no matter how the game phrases things, whether the game says you must do this in this order, you can, you should, some weird backwards game that says, you know, never do this. One of my recent games has rule zero for glitch is you're not playing glitch. But no matter how you approach that, in the end, you have the book that's an inanimate object. And you have the players, and they're like brilliant sparks in the endless void. The book cannot tell them what to do anyway. All it can do is be there to like raise them up a little bit. An assistive device. The book is an assistive device for free play.
Yeah, I guess it gives lore for people to play with.
Yeah. One of my better games, even though it's never had a proper publication, was Weaver, the Argist Fatalist, which basically had three character classes. There was the Fatalist, who actually knew things about the world, the Theurgist, who actually interacted with the gameplay, and the Weaver, who was basically managing the player group. And the whole game was focused on the idea that, like, these are completely independent processes to some extent. The rules don't have to care about what the Fatalist, what the setting says. The people involved with managing the group can actually sort of ignore the rules, too. There's all this going on. And I've forgotten the question that got me here, so I'm going to end there.
Okay. So, apart from your own games, I'm making the assumption you like your own games because you've created them. Which other games do you like the most and why?
So I think I kind of always thought that Carcassonne is basically perfect. I don't even like the gameplay of it that much, but like I was talking about earlier, you need the things for your brain to engage with. And the actual play for Carcassonne is so thematic and pleasant as an experience that all the gameplay really has to do is like engage the ludological part of your brain, you know, keep you thinking about what you're doing, and then you can just enjoy the experience. So,
yeah, I agree with you. Carcassonne is just a game you can just, although it's deceptively simple, you can just play it and play it and play it and play it. And I've done that in sort of summer holidays with the kids on Carcassonne. We've taken loads of games with us and we've ended up playing Carcassonne all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Digital version of Wingspan too, I think. It's probably my second favorite. I get overwhelmed by the pieces in the physical form, but the digital form is just, it's so beautiful. And it works so well.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I totally agree. The sounds and the aesthetics are a level up the digital version.
I was very excited to see a newsletter from Elizabeth Hargrave this week, and I haven't actually read the newsletter, so I don't know if it's her game or somebody else's game, but there's a game called Wormspan coming out, which is it's basically the Wingspan mechanics but for dragons.
Yeah, I'm so excited to see that. Oh my god, yes, I'm reading carefully every newsletter that I get.
Oh wow,
I'm very excited about that.
yeah. It's the same team, but with some extra people, I believe. Ah. But yeah, it's basically the same main author behind it. So that's amazing.
Cool.
I will look forward to that. Wow. I listened to your interview of her. She's really good and smart.
So yeah, speaking of game authors, then we can continue with the next question, which is which other game designers would you like to see on this podcast?
Vincent McGay Baker have already been recommended on your podcast. I don't remember who it was, but one of the ones that I listened to. And they're great because even aside from the games, if you read their process posts, if you read their blog posts, it's just really clear and crisp thinking. And so I assume they'd be a great guest. If that's too much of a duplicate of something you've already had, I would honestly love to hear from Justin Ma and Matthew Davis, who did the Into the Breach game, because that's just such an amazing technical accomplishment. And I'd like to know if they think that it has any relevance to litagogical stuff, to gamification of life and learning.
Well, we'd definitely love to have Vincent McKay-Baker on. I absolutely love sort of Powered by the Apocalypse games, and yes, to be able to talk to them would be really great. Yeah. I don't know Into the Breach. Can you explain?
It's a computer game that is... So the setting doesn't really matter that much into what the core coolness of it is. It's like playing chess. It's very... You're in mechs and you're fighting off giant bugs to preserve a city, but they balanced it so perfectly that every turn the enemies show you exactly what they're going to do, kind of like, you know, Wingspan's bot, and it's always on this knife edge of, you know, can I stop them from hurting civilians? Can I stop them from killing my mechs? Can I be more efficient about how to do this and achieve objectives? And a lot of it is just execution, but also when you play it, it's like with Carcassonne. It's just so beautifully engineered. Yeah, that's roughly what it is. When you die in the game, you start over as in a different parallel timeline. It's just really good.
Cool. I'll definitely check it out. Mentioning obviously Vincent McKay-Baker and you took the two games you've talked about are obviously sort of tabletop sort of board games, but I mean you've written some of my favourite RPGs, so I do have to ask you for some RPG recommendations as well.
The thing here is that loving games and feeling kind of a professional obligation to play a bunch of games doesn't always translate into getting a group. When I was in China, I spent years there and in Taiwan. And during that whole time, I was able to get in about two sessions because I don't speak Chinese. I'm terrible at languages. I did my best, but it certainly wasn't the level of going and playing in a group. ES Press, I worked with them a little bit to, you know, run a couple playtest sessions. And that was about all I could manage. And then I came back to the States, and things were better, but, you know, scheduling is hard. Groups are hard. I was 30 pounds underweight and had to physically recover. I got some play in, but then the pandemic hit and I've been exhausted ever since. And so I would like to say, you know, there are all these games that I love in concept. Powered by the Apocalypse stuff, Forged in the Dark stuff, Polaris, Fiasco, Wander Home, the Leverage game. And the best game I've had the chance to play was probably Exalted Third Edition, which is a technical masterpiece. I talk a lot about technical masterpieces because they're what I love, but I don't think that Exalted 3 is necessarily better than all those other games I listed. I just don't know. So that's about as well as I can do there for that question.
I definitely agree with you about Wander Home, and I haven't had the chance to play that as much as I would like as well. You know, it is the problem of getting people together, getting a group together, particularly in COVID times.
Yeah, I isolated for a year with a bunch of gamers, and everyone was so drained that we couldn't manage it. So,
such a beautiful game, though. It's both the art and the... I find the game transformative in its structure. So I don't know if you find the same. And
yeah,
maybe you can explain how you feel about it.
I mean, I read it. I thought it was beautiful. I thought it was really interesting. I took, I think, some advice from it in building the fire roofs. I was interested in the general approach it had to what do you do next. And that turned for the fire roofs, that turned into basically, here's a list of things you can say when you're the GM or some facilitated player at this point in the game. And it's not exactly the same, but I definitely picked that up from playing reading Wonder Home. I haven't had the chance to play though, so maybe it's better than I think. Maybe it'll fall apart if I actually try to play it with my particular game assumptions.
Mm.
It's great, but I haven't played it.
So you've just mentioned Far Roofs, and I'm dying to find out more about that. So Jay Dragon was playtesting that while talking to us on the podcast. Well, not literally at the same time, but at the same time, sort of, you know, whatever. And I've been looking forward to it ever since. So tell us a bit about Far Roofs. Tell us what people can look forward to and about the upcoming Kickstarter as well.
So the basic story of Far Roofs is that if you go up on the roofs of your hometown, even your house, and you go from one to the other, you know, you jump or walk, let's assume that they're close enough you can, and you go up, do this for long enough, you go out far enough, the roofs will start to run together like water, become a landscape all its own, and it becomes hard to tell that there are still buildings underneath, you're not sure. Gets more and more magical, and it's a land of monsters, but it's still this magical land that's right next door, above. And nominally, at least, you play yourselves. The game doesn't require that, but the best playtest sessions were the ones where people played themselves, or some variant on themselves. And because that's what it's about. It's about the experience of magic coming into your life. And it has talking rats. They're cool, but they're basically playing the role of psychopomps only for a living world. They're the ones who go up there and spend a lot of time there, basically standing between the two worlds of us below and the Far Roofs beyond. And after developing them for so long, I love them. I hope other people will too. You're challenging the mysteries, which are basically god monsters. They're things that are so vast and magical that it's a lot to ask for people playing themselves to be able to deal with them at all. But sometimes you can't avoid it. And besides, you're bigger than a rat.
What's not to love with rats, though? I have had several pet rats, and they are amongst the most lovable creatures in the world, as far as I'm concerned.
They are. Yeah. They're amazing. So, yeah, it's really a game about the experience of being there somewhere wonderful, and I'm really hoping people will love it.
Mm.
I went to a great deal of difficulty to make it affordable. I should have written it at like 1,000 pages. It came out 223 because I wanted to make sure that I could get a print-on-demand copy to people, the hardship tier of the Kickstarter, that would cost under $15 with the shipping and the printing and stuff. So that was a big constraint on things, but I really want to bring people into somewhere beautiful. So that's the Far Roofs.
I mean, I think that's what's certainly to me, and I think for a lot of other people as well, that's what's so attractive about games such as the games that you write, is this element of world building and these fantastic universes that you can enter just by playing a game. And to me, that is, it's really magical in itself.
Yeah, and you don't just get to have like a third person point of view by reading a novel or watching a movie. You do get an experiential. You're part of the game as well. You're part of this virtual world that you're playing. You're not just observing it from a distance.
Yeah, I think that's critically important, at least for the kinds of games I do. I know there are probably indie people out there shaking their heads and going, well, I have a game over here where you're not actually there. You're just, you know, a second person or God observing or something. And that's all really cool art. But yeah, I think you're totally right that the experience is at the core.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and we all need more magic in our lives as well, definitely. Obviously, you've got a lot of experience in games design. So what piece of advice would you give to someone who's starting out in the field, who's starting out with their first games designs, for example?
I have a lot of advice, if that's okay.
No, that's fine.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the first thing you have to know is that success is going to depend on a lucky break. You can be good. I mean, you have to be good but a lot of people are good. You have to work hard. A lot of people work hard. So be prepared for the fact that you're not going to get the public's attention for something self-published or a publisher's attention for something you're submitting without basically a lucky break of some sort. I have no idea how common they are. I can't say, oh, it's probably about, you know, as much time working before it hits as with me, because that's just survivorship bias. Mm. But you have to be prepared going in to either wait as long as it takes or to know when to stop, because until you hit that lucky break, it's not going to go anywhere. I would say that you should speak from the heart, because a lot of people who are starting games, they are focused on the setting, you know, this cool city I want to make, or they're focused mm-hmm. on the rules. I want to change this bit of my favorite game. And I think all of that is like going out to the ocean and pushing on the wave, where yes, you move water, but the deep structure is still there. And the deep structure you have to be changing is basically your voice. Like, you have to be speaking with your authentic voice rather than worrying about all the surface stuff, or will it come out good? Mm-hmm. I think that while it's fairly obvious that you should lean into what people are liking about the work that you have already, I think it's worth considering leaning into what people vociferously hate about your work, because it's like the same principle as no bad publicity, right? The stuff that people notice is the stuff that you're doing differently. It's part of the thing you have to offer to bring to the gaming world. Even if what they're noticing is, I hate this, as long as it's not something that's just an obvious error on your part, consider leaning into it and see where that takes you to. Because I mentioned Wisher Theurgist Fatalist earlier. That game was really just a self-parody. People were talking about some of the less enjoyable parts of my game, and I decided to just go all into it. And it's probably one of my most popular games, certainly among other designers. It opens with like communication is violence, perception is violence. It's that kind of gaming world, and it worked really well.
Yeah, I think it's that idea that certainly there used to be an idea and sort of persists quite a lot now when I talk to people about games, that, you know, games are supposed to be, you know, make you giddy with fun. But those aren't the most interesting games. The most interesting games are the games that give you lots and lots of different kinds of fun. And some of that can be really difficult and disturbing fun.
Yes.
Because it's making you think and it's challenging you.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Most people complain about my games being weird, so that's not the lane that I go into. But like, yeah, there are people out there who've been making more and more difficult games, more and more disturbing games, more and more challenging games. And yeah, if that's what people are noticing, then lean into it.
Yeah, because I was thinking, you know, if you're just going out to make a game which is relentless fun to play, then basically you've just created a party game, and there's plenty of those to go around already.
Yes.
They're not as interesting, are they? Which I think they don't hold interest for a longer period of time.
Yeah. Nothing's wrong with them, but they don't have the values that we talked about.
Yeah.
Not as transformative, for sure.
I want to make sure to say, in terms of advice, to be careful of work for hire contracts. It's fine if, like, you know, you're working for Blizzard doing something about World of Warcraft and, you know, orc culture in World of Warcraft or whatever. Sure, you're not going to feel any ownership of that anyway. Do it work for hire, let Blizzard on it. But if it's something that you might want to iterate on later, something that's about you, be really careful and know what you're doing if you're going to do a work for hire contract and give that up. Even if nobody in the game world can really sue one another, there's still the sense of moral connection to the work that you're losing. And also don't give artists work for hire contracts either. Give them, you know, unlimited use or single use. Don't try to take away what they have, because that's cruel. Publishers and distributors will steal from you. That's important to know. be prepared for it. Have your eggs in multiple baskets.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, it's coming from you because you've worked in so many different facets of the industry because you started out writing for existing games, for example, and then moved to creating your own games. So I suppose you've seen it from all of these different angles. So valuable advice from somebody who knows.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
It's pretty practical. So I appreciate it for that reason.
I did not know at first. I thought that, you know, once I was being published, that was it. I had at least, you know, the extent that gaming is a career at all, I had that locked up. And then distributor, as far as anyone could tell, just kind of walked off with the print run. Started selling it themselves for without dealing with me or the publisher. And that kind of thing can happen. Just, yeah, be prepared.
Yeah, lessons you learn the hard way.
Yeah. A last piece of advice for people getting into game design is to take care of yourself, really, because it really is important for the quality of your work to be as, to have your mind as well fed as possible. Ideally, your body. I realize not everyone can force that, but, you know, good food, sunlight, friends, it's hope and happiness. It's important. And don't let the world or the game or something get in the way of that. If you don't have it, if you're in bad circumstances, you can reach for things you have to say. You can reach for, you know, anger or grief or anything and, you know, use that to drive you. But the only way you can, like, just sit down and make a game because you want to make a game is if you're getting a lot of stuff from the world. So take care of yourself.
That's great advice. And yeah, speaking of lessons, what then would be lessons that you've learned from that can be applied outside? Although you mentioned already all that in the advice, but I'm wondering if you can add to that.
Oh, lessons from game design that can be applied outside of games. I think it's important that in games, you're dealing with a world that's not a physical thing. It's just an experience, right? It's easy to miss that if you're really into setting stuff. You're like, oh, this is how the world is. But there isn't any how the world is in games. There's just how you experience it. So the fact that we can experience the world in different ways, the fact that what really matters is people and how they're actually experiencing things is something that's easier to see in games than in real life. But once you see it, you're like, ah, you know, walls may be tactile, doors may be solid, tables may be solid, but there are all these things that you believe are immutable about the world that might just be how you're thinking about it. And I think that's something that you can pull out of games usefully. That you can choose how you're experiencing things to some extent. That you can choose to say, this experience will be beautiful, this experience will matter. And there was this one thing which I wanted to take an opportunity to mention, which is mostly in terms of like lessons coming out of games for more litigological things, more gamifying of reality, is that, and this is just my personal stream of game design rather than games in general, you're not limited in gamification to purely the feedback loop of, you know, I do a leg lift, I get 1 XP, eventually I level up, which is great, but at least for the people who that works for. But in addition to stuff like, oh, clean a room, get 1 XP towards your clean house chart, there's also, you can use games and the active attention that you apply in games to understand the world you're in and the story you're telling yourself about it. Not just I cleaned +1 XP, but also I'm coughing more. I'm walking around things more. I don't have energy to deal with, you know, the latest cat vomit. And at some point you can go, ah, this means I really need to clean up. but that might not be obvious otherwise. You know, there's this internet saying, I tried to find out who said it first. I could not. That if you're hating yourself, you might need to sleep. If you're hating everyone else, you might be hungry. And that's kind of a game thinking, right? You know, it's like, I noticed this. Therefore, I must be under the condition hungry or the condition sleepy. I found this out by taking the Chubo's Marvelous Wish Granting Engine RPG quest system and trying to use it on my life. And what I found was it didn't actually tell me when things would happen or what I needed to do next. But I could often look through it to say, this is where I think I am. These clues are telling me what story I am building for myself. And I think that's, I couldn't find it at least in existing stuff. I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And if people want to find out more about Jenna Moran, where should they go?
So I do have a website, ninuan.org, ninuan.org, that has links to a lot of my stuff. There's currently the landing page for the Far Roofs up on Kickstarter. I have a Discord with a fair bit of my fan base. If you have questions, you can find the public invite link a couple places on the web. You can buy my games. That always works. You can listen to the Ludagogy podcast. That at least this episode. It may be too late to bring that out to people, but it's there.
All right. We'll make sure to include the links in the description.
Thank you.
Well, Jenna, it's been wonderful to have you as our guest.
Well, thank you very much, Jenna. That's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. And I, for one, will be probably spending the rest of the evening digging back into Hitherby Dragons, which I've been enjoying very much in the week running up to this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a wonderful being here.
And this has been the Ludogogy Podcast.
Game over.